Dinner with secretary. Monday night at 8 o'clock, I'm in my office, attempting yesterday's New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle, listening to rap music on the stereo, trying to fathom its popularity. Since a little blonde hard body I met at O-Bar two nights ago told me that rap is all she listens to, and though later I beat the living shit out of her at someone's apartment in the Dakota, she was almost decapitated, hardly a strange experience for me. Earlier this morning, her taste in music haunted my memory, and I had to stop at Tower Records on the Upper West Side and buy $90 worth of rap CDs, but, as expected, I'm at a loss. Niggerish voices uttering ugly words like digit, pudding, skunk. Jean sits at her desk, which is piled high with reams of documents that I want her to go over. Today has not been bad. I worked out for 2 hours before the office. The new Robeson Hirsch restaurant called Finna opened in Chelsea. Evelyn left two messages on my answering machine and another with Jean, letting me know that she'll be in Boston for most of the week. And best of all, the Patty Winters show this morning was in two parts. The first was an exclusive interview with Donald Trump. The second was a report on women who've been tortured. I'm supposed to have dinner with Madison Gray and David Campion at Café Luxembourg, but at 8:15 I find out that Lewis Carruthers is going to be dining with us, so I call up Campion, the dumb bastard, and cancel, then spend minutes debating about what I should do with the rest of the evening. Looking out my window, I realize that within moments the sky above this city will be completely dark. Jean peers into my office, knocking gently on the half-open door. I pretend not to acknowledge her presence, though I'm not sure why, since I'm kind of lonely. She moves up to the desk. I'm still staring at the crossword puzzle with my Wayfarers on, stunned, but for no real reason. She places a file on top of the desk before asking, "Doing the crossword?" Dropping the G in doing, a pathetic gesture of intimacy, an irritating stab of forced friendliness. I gag inwardly, then nod without looking up at her. "Need help?" she asks, moving cautiously around the desk to where I sit, and she leans over my shoulder to offer assistance. I've already filled in every space with either the word meat or bone, and she emits only a slight gasp when noticing this. And when she sees the pile of number two pencils I've snapped in half lying on my desk, she dutifully picks them up and walks out of the room. "Jean," I call. "Yes, Patrick?" She re-enters the office, trying to downplay her eagerness. "Would you like to accompany me to dinner?" I ask, still staring at the crossword, gingerly erasing the M in one of the many meats I've filled the puzzle with. "That is, if you're not doing anything?" "Oh, no," she answers too quickly, and then I think, realizing this quickness, she says, "I have no plans." "Well, isn't this a coincidence?" I ask, looking up, lowering my Wayfarers. She laughs slightly, but there's a real urgency in it, something uncomfortable, and this does little in the way of making me feel less sick. "I guess," she shrugs. "I also have tickets to a Milla Vanilla concert, if you'd like to go," I tell her casually. Confused, she asks, "Really? Who?" "Milla Vanilla," I repeat slowly. "Milla Vanilla," she asks uncomfortably. "Milla Vanilla," I say. "I think that's what their name is." She says, "I'm not sure." "About going?" "No, of the name." She concentrates, then says, "I think they're called Milli Vanilli." I pause for a long time before saying, "Oh." She stands there, nods once more. "It doesn't matter," I say. "I don't have any tickets to it anyway. It's months from now." "Oh," she says, nodding again. "Okay. Listen, where should we go?" I lean back and pull my zagat from the desk's top drawer. She pauses, afraid of what to say, taking my question as a test she needs to pass. And then, unsure she's chosen the right answer, offers, "Anywhere you want." "No, no, no," I smile, leafing through the booklet. "How about anywhere you want?" Oh, Patrick, I can't make this decision. Oh, come on, I urge. Anywhere you want. Oh, I can't. Helplessly, she sighs again. I don't know. Come on, I urge her. Where do you want to go? Anywhere you want. Just say it. I can get us in anywhere. She thinks about it for a long time, and then, sensing her time is running out, timidly asks, trying to impress me, what about Dorsia? I stop looking through the Zagat guide, and without glancing up, smiling tightly, stomach dropping, I silently ask myself, do I really want to say no? Do I really want to say I can't possibly get us in? Is that what I'm really prepared to do? Is that what I really want to do? So, I say, placing the book down, then nervously opening it up again to find the number. Dorsia is where Jean wants to go. Oh, I don't know, she says, confused. No, we'll go anywhere you want. Dorsia is fine, I say casually, picking up the phone, and with a trembling finger very quickly dial the 7 dreaded numbers, trying to remain cool. Instead of the busy signal I'm expecting, the phone actually rings at Dorsia, and after 2 rings, the same harassed voice I've grown accustomed to for the past 3 months answers, shouting out, Dorsia, yes? The room behind the voice is a deafening hum. Yes, can you take 2 tonight? Oh, let's say in around 20 minutes, I ask, checking my Rolex, offering Jean a wink. She seems impressed. We are totally booked, the maitre d' shouts out smugly. Oh, really, I say, trying to look pleased, on the verge of vomiting. That's great. I said we are totally booked, he shouts. 2 at 9, I say, perfect. There are no tables available tonight, the maitre d' unflappable drones. The waiting list is also totally booked. He hangs up. See you then. I hang up too. And with a smile that tries its best to express pleasure at her choice, I find myself fighting for breath, every muscle tensed sharply. Jean is wearing a wool jersey and flannel dress by Calvin Klein, an alligator belt with a silver buckle by Barry Kieselstein Cord, silver earrings and clear stockings, also by Calvin Klein. She stands there in front of the desk, confused. Yes, I ask, walking over to the coat rack. You're dressed okay. She pauses. You didn't give them a name, she says softly. I think about this while putting on my Armani jacket and while re-knotting my Armani silk tie, and without stammering, I tell her, they know me. While the maitre d' seats a couple whom I'm pretty sure are Kate Spencer and Jason Lauder, Jean and I move up to his podium where the reservation book lies open, names absurdly legible, and leaning over it, casually I spot the only name for 2 at 9 without a line drawn through it, which happens to be, oh Jesus, Schrotz. I sigh, and tapping my foot, my mind racing, I try to concoct some kind of feasible plan. Suddenly I turn to Jean and say, why don't you go to the women's room? She's looking around the restaurant, taking it in. Chaos. People are waiting 10 deep at the bar. The maitre d' seats the couple at a table in the middle of the room. Sylvester Stallone and a bimbo sit in the front booth that Sean and I sat in just weeks before, much to my sickened amazement. And his bodyguards are piled into the booth next to that. And the owner of Petty's, Norman Prager, lounges in the third. Jean turns her head to me and shouts, what? Over the din. Don't you want to use the ladies' room? I ask. The maitre d' nears us, picking his way through the packed restaurant, unsmiling. Why? I mean, do I? She asks, totally confused. Just go, I hiss, desperately squeezing her arm. But I don't need to, Patrick, she protests. Oh, Christ, I mutter. Now it's too late anyway. The maitre d' walks up to the podium and inspects the book, takes a phone call, hangs up in a matter of seconds. then looks over at us, not exactly displeased. The maitre d' is at least 50 and has a ponytail. I clear my throat twice to get his full attention, make some kind of lame eye contact. "Yes," he asks, as if harassed. I give him a dignified expression before sighing inside. "Reservations at 9? I gulp. "For 2? "Yes," he asks suspiciously, drawing the word out. "Name?" he says. Then turns to a passing waiter, 18 and model handsome, who'd asked, "Where's the ice?" He's glaring and shouting, "Not now, okay? How many times do you need to be told?" The waiter shrugs humbly, and then the maitre d' points off toward the bar. "The ice is over there." He turns back to us, and I am genuinely frightened. "Name," he commands. And I'm thinking, of all the fucking names, why this one? Schrotz. Oh, God. "Mr. and Mrs. Schrotz." My face, I'm sure, is ashen, and I say the name mechanically, but the maitre d' is too busy not to buy it. And I don't even bother to face Jean, who I'm sure is totally bewildered by my behavior, as we're led to the Schrotz's table, which I'm sure probably sucks, though I'm relieved anyway. Menus already lie on the table, but I'm so nervous the words and even the prices look like hieroglyphics, and I'm completely at a loss. A waiter takes our drink order, the same one who couldn't locate the ice, and I find myself saying things without listening to Jean, like, "Protecting the ozone layer is a really cool idea," and telling knock-knock jokes. I smile, fixing it on my face, in another country, and it takes no time at all, minutes really. The waiter doesn't even get a chance to tell us about the specials, for me to notice the tall, handsome couple by the podium conferring with the maitre d', and after sighing very deeply, lightheaded, stammering, I mention to Jean, "Something bad is happening." She looks up from the menu and puts down the iceless drink she's been sipping. "Why? What's wrong?" The maitre d' is glaring over at us, at me, from across the room, as he leads the couple toward our table. If the couple had been short, dumpy, excessively Jewish, I could have kept this table, even without the aid of a 50, but this couple looks like they've just strolled out of a Ralph Lauren ad, and though Jean and I do too, and so does the rest of the whole goddamn restaurant, the man is wearing a tuxedo, and the girl, a totally fuckable babe, is covered with jewels. This is reality, and as my loathsome brother Sean would say, I have to deal with it. The maitre d' now stands at the table, hands clasped behind his back, unamused, and after a long pause asks, "Mr. and Mrs. Schrotz?" "Yes." I play it cool. He just stares. This is accompanied by an abnormal silence. His ponytail, gray and oily, hangs like some kind of malignancy below his collar. "You know," I finally say, somewhat suavely, "I happen to know the chef." He continues staring. So, no doubt, does the couple behind him. After another long pause, for no real reason, I ask, "Is he in Aspen?" This is getting nowhere. I sigh and turn to Jean, who looks completely mystified. "Let's go, okay?" She nods dumbly. Humiliated, I take Jean's hand and we get up, she slower than I, brushing past the maitre d' and the couple, and make our way back through the crowded restaurant. And then we're outside, and I'm utterly devastated and murmuring robotically to myself, "I should have known better, I should have known better, I should have..." But Jean skips down the street laughing, pulling me along. And when I finally notice her unexpected mirth, between giggles she lets out, "That was so funny!" And then squeezing my clenched fist, she lets me know, "Your sense of humor is so spontaneous!" Shaken, walking stiffly by her side, ignoring her, I ask myself, where to now? And in seconds come up with an answer, Arcadia, toward which I find myself guiding us. After someone who I think is Hamilton Conway mistakes me for someone named Ted Owen and asks if I can get him into Petty's tonight, I tell him, "I'll see what I can do." Then turn what's left of my attention to Jean, who sits across from me in the near-empty dining room of Arcadia. After he leaves, only 5 of the restaurant's tables have people at them. I've ordered a J&B on the rocks, Jean sipping a glass of white wine and talking about how what she really wants to do is get into merchant banking. And I'm thinking, dare to dream. Someone else, Frederick Dibble, stops by and congratulates me on the Larson account and then has the nerve to say, "Talk to you later, Saul." But I'm in a daze, millions of miles away, and Jean doesn't notice. She's talking about a new novel she's been reading, by some young author. Its cover, I've seen, slathered with neon, its subject, lofty suffering. Accidentally, I think she's talking about something else, and I find myself saying, without really looking over at her, "You need a tough skin to survive in this city." She flushes, seems embarrassed, and takes another sip of the wine, which is a nice Sauvignon Blanc. "You seem distant," she says. "What?" I ask, blinking. "I said you seem distant," she says. "No," I sigh. "I'm still my same kooky self." "That's good." She smiles. Am I dreaming this? Relieved? "So, listen," I say, trying to focus in on her. "What do you really want to do with your life?" Then, remembering how she was droning on about a career in merchant banking, I add, "Just briefly, you know, summarize." Then I add, "And don't tell me you enjoy working with children, okay?" "Well, I'd like to travel," she says, "and maybe go back to school, but I don't really know." She pauses thoughtfully and announces sincerely, "I'm at a point in my life where there seems to be a lot of possibilities, but I'm so, I don't know, unsure." I think it's also important for people to realize their limitations. Then out of the blue I ask, "Do you have a boyfriend?" She smiles shyly, blushes, and then says, "No, not really." "Interesting," I murmur. I've opened my menu, and I'm studying tonight's prefix dinner. "Are you seeing anyone?" she ventures timidly. "I mean, seriously?" I decide on the pilot fish with tulips and cinnamon, evading the question by sighing, "I just want to have a meaningful relationship with someone special." And before she's allowed to respond, I ask her what she's going to order. "I think the mahi-mahi," she says, and then squinting at the menu, "with ginger." "I'm having the pilot fish," I say. "I'm developing a taste for them, for pilot fish," I say, nodding. Later, after a mediocre dinner, a bottle of expensive California Cabernet Sauvignon, and a creme brulee that we share, I order a glass of $50 port, and Jean sips a decaffeinated espresso, and when she asks where the restaurant got its name, I tell her, and I don't make anything ridiculous up, though I'm tempted, just to see if she'd believe it anyway. Sitting across from Jean right now in the darkness of Arcadia, it's very easy to believe that she would swallow any kind of misinformation I push her way. The crush she has on me rendering her powerless. And I find this lack of defense oddly unerotic. I could even explain my pro-apartheid stance and have her find reasons why she, too, should share them and invest large sums of money in racist corporations that Arcadia was an ancient region in Peloponnesus, Greece, which was founded in 370 BC, and it was completely surrounded by mountains. Its chief city was Megalopolis, which was also the center of political activity and the capital of the Arcadian Confederacy. I take a sip of the port, which is thick, strong, expensive. It was destroyed during the Greek War of Independence. I pause again. Pan was worshipped originally in Arcadia. Do you know who Pan was? Never taking her eyes off me, she nods. His revels were very similar to those of Bacchus, I tell her. He frolicked with nymphs at night, but he also liked to frighten travelers during the day. Hence the word panic. Blah, blah, blah. I'm amused that I've retained this knowledge, and I look up from the port I've been staring thoughtfully into and smile at her. She's silent for a long time, confused, unsure of how to respond, but eventually she looks deeply into my eyes and says haltingly, leaning across the table, "That's so interesting." Which is all that comes out of her mouth, is all she has to say. 11:34. We stand on the sidewalk in front of Jean's apartment on the Upper East Side. Her doorman eyes us warily and fills me with a nameless dread, his gaze piercing me from the lobby. A curtain of stars, miles of them, are scattered, glowing across the sky, and their multitude humbles me, which I have a hard time tolerating. She shrugs and nods after I say something about forms of anxiety. It's as if her mind is having a hard time communicating with her mouth, as if she is searching for a rational analysis of who I am, which is, of course, an impossibility. There is no key. "Dinner was wonderful," she says. "Thank you very much." "Actually, the food was mediocre, but you're welcome." I shrug. "Do you want to come up for a drink?" she says, too casually. And even though I'm critical of her approach, it doesn't necessarily mean that I don't want to go up. But something stops me. Something quells the bloodlust. The doorman? The way the lobby is lit? Her lipstick? Plus, I'm beginning to think that pornography is so much less complicated than actual sex. And because of this lack of complication, so much more pleasurable. "Do you have any peyote?" I ask. She pauses, confused. "What?" "Just a joke," I say. "Then, listen, I want to watch David Letterman, so..." I pause, unsure as to why I'm lingering. "I should go." "You can watch it," she stops and suggests. "At my place." I pause before asking, "Do you have cable?" "Yes," she nods. "I have cable." Stuck, I pause again, then pretend to mull it over. "No, it's okay. I like to watch it without cable." She offers a sad, perplexed glance. "What?" "I have to return some videotapes," I explain in a rush. She pauses. "Now?" "It's..." She checks her watch. "Almost midnight." "Well, yeah," I say, considerably detached. "Well, I guess it's good night, then," she says. What kind of books does Jean read? Titles race through my mind. How to Make a Man Fall in Love with You. How to Keep a Man in Love with You Forever. How to Close a Deal. Get Married. How to Be Married 1 Year from Today. Supplicant. In my overcoat pocket, I finger the ostrich condom case from Luc Benoit I bought last week, but, no. After awkwardly shaking hands, she asks, still holding mine, "Really? You don't have cable?" And though it has been in no way a romantic evening, she embraces me, and this time emanates a warmth I'm not familiar with. I'm so used to imagining everything happening the way it occurs in movies, visualizing things falling somehow into the shape of events on a screen, that I almost hear the swelling of an orchestra, can almost hallucinate the camera panning low around us, fireworks bursting in slow motion overhead, the 70-millimeter image of her lips parting and the subsequent murmur of, "I want you," in Dolby sound. But my embrace is frozen, and I realize, at first distantly, and then with greater clarity, that the havoc raging inside me is gradually subsiding, and she is kissing me on the mouth, and this jars me back into some kind of reality, and I lightly push her away. She glances up at me fearfully. "Listen, I've got to go," I say, checking my Rolex. "I don't want to miss stupid pet tricks." "Okay," she says, composing herself. "Bye." "Night," I say. We both head off in our separate directions, but suddenly she calls out something. I turn around. "Don't forget you have a breakfast meeting with Frederick Bennett and Charles Rust at 21. She says from the door, which the doorman is holding open for her. "Thanks," I call out, waving. "It slipped my mind completely." She waves back, disappearing into the lobby. On my way over to Park Avenue, I find a cab, and I pass an ugly homeless bum, a member of the genetic underclass, and when he softly pleads for change, for anything, I notice the Barnes & Noble book bag that sits next to him on the steps of the church he's begging on. And I can't help but smirk out loud. "Oh, right. Like you read." And then in the back of the cab on the way across town to my apartment, I imagine running around Central Park on a cool spring afternoon with Jean, laughing, holding hands. We buy balloons. We let them go.